The hope of our Bible is unashamedly utopian. It shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains. And it shall be exalted above the hills, and many nations shall come unto it. And many people shall go up and say, Who shall ascend into the mountain of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? And he will judge between many peoples, and he will decide between nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not make war against nation, neither shall they wage war any more. But they shall sit, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. Armed with this mandate, which corroborated man's own instinctive optimism, we set out to organize and civilize the world. Wattle huts became skyscraper cities. We learned to count, to build computers, to read, to write, to pass down through libraries the inherited insight of the ages. And such was the thrust, the drive of progress in these last generations, that it was conceivable that we could engineer a society innocent of poverty and guilty only of being unequal to the challenge of man's mortality. We ought then at this juncture of time to be brimful with confidence, aggressive, staunch, hopeful. Strangely, this is anything but the case. 2 millennia ago, when there was no reasonable expectation of changing the order of the world, when men wrote realistically that the poor shall always be among us, minds of the quality of Isaiah's and Micah's and Plato's wrote utopias, glorious dramatic visions of heaven come to earth. Paradoxically today, men paint the future when they think of it in nightmare, garish colors. I give you George Orwell's 1984. Robot men, prisoner of their own machines, stultified lives. And I remind you that 1984 is but 21 years hence. I give you Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, which is anything but brave and new. Cowardly, craven men, unequal to the simplest tasks, without a spark of generosity or of heroism within them. I give you Ionesco's new play, Rhinoceros, where the prophecy seems to be that it shall come to pass in the end of days that all men will become insane, and that the call of the jungle will be heard throughout our cities. This is the future, when men admit the possibility of any future. For our literature is filled with those who insist that we will soon light our own funeral pyre, and who design for us books which dramatize the macabre dance as we disport ourselves around this funereal flame. Why so? Why at this moment, when we are pushing back the ignorance which surrounds, when we are for the first time producing a sufficiency of goods, why now, when the good life is so near that we can touch it, are men throwing up their hands in despair, lamenting, whimpering about their fate? Why? Because man has lost a sense of pride in himself, a sense of respect for his own basic decency and for the decency of his fellow men. When our painters set out to draw symbolically the portrait of mankind, they give us, as Picasso did in his Guernica, a vision of steel-colored, bitter men, half men, half carrion, their faces distorted with the seething violence within. Not a moment, not a glance of decency and sympathy playing on their faces. When our writers write our autobiography, they speak of us as lustful, greedy animals in disguised in human clothes, perpetual carpetbaggers, shoddy, vile. And if they do not paint us in these animal colors, they write of us as if we are pygmy peoples with pygmy ambitions and limited minds. William Golding's Lord of the Flies, man unequal to crisis, unable to surmount himself, to be heroic, to be a man, even in a moment of ultimate extremity. What you say? Rabbi, these are our artists and our writers, the men who traditionally emote, put enthusiasm, emotion above reason. Are they not simply drawing too black a picture? I wonder if we have all not been infected with this despondency and this dyspepsia. When we see a simple act of kindness, are we not prone to scalpel behind it? To look for some ulterior motive? And have many of us not come to the unspoken conclusion that our home, the circle of our friends, is a small island of security, of civilization, in a violence, in a violent city, in a violent world, which we would best forget about? How glad we were that we didn't have the headlines of our papers each morning to disturb our coffee. The clearest, or some of the clearest, of the thinkers of our day have joined in labeling man's incapacity. Dr. Sigmund Freud spoke of man as a savage beast to whom the very thought of sacrificing his own is not alien. And he wrote these words in a book called Civilization and Its Discontents, hardly a utopian tract. The most prominent of Christian theologians, Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr, has found it necessary to resurrect in this enlightened century the medieval doctrine of original sin, that man is hobbled, crippled, emotionally and psychologically, so much so that we can never surmount the instinct within. We have never a sufficiency of character, of will, of discipline to truly equal the challenges and meet them of our day. Bertrand Russell, the British mathematician and philosopher, with his usual bluntness, put it this way: man is the incommensurate idiot of the universe. Now, these are not glib neurotics spouting Madison Avenue shock labels in order to draw attention unto themselves. These are sober, clear-eyed men who are disturbed, profoundly disturbed by our human situation. Why so? Why is there this mist of despair and despondency about ourselves? Is it really hard to understand? Lidice explains it. Coventry explains it. So does Dachau, and Bergen Belsen, and Auschwitz. So does a cold war which is burning around the edges. And most of all, daily headlines from our own Southland telling us that men who are raised in a Sunday school tradition, who have been taught of morality, who have books on their shelves explaining the scientific truth about race, persist in this century to blind their own eyes and their own hearts. And in brief, reason, sweet reason, education, humanistic education, religion, our great Judeo-Christian tradition, that these, the hopes of men combined, are not equal. In great parts of the earth, the challenge of civilizing, educating, and modernizing an enlightening man. Moreover, so much in our scientific age seems to give a disciplined basis to these claims. In the field of biology, this cult of despair has drawn the idea that since man is descended from lower forms of animals, he is jungle. He can never escape the jungle. And that all that differentiates him from other men is a more flexible thumb and a more adaptable forebrain. This is to distort evolution. But this is as it is understood. And from the world of chemistry and of biology, from the discipline of science itself, the cult of despair draws the idea that man is organically related to all other matter, that we are simply a bit of irritated protoplasm, that any feeling we have about consciousness, character, will is illusion, false. From Dr. Freud's rich treasury of ideas, the cult of despair has emphasized that what is virtuous may not really be so. That charity may be a neurotic response to guilt. That goodness may be a desperate appeal for attention. That even the martyr may simply be a pathetic individual with a powerful death wish roiling within. What is man? Where is man? Where is the human? Mirror, mirror on the wall. Are we so awful after all? I respect those who lead this movement. I understand their shock and sympathize with their anger at the violence in our world. But as a rabbi, as the inheritor of a tradition of 4,000 years of living, and the insight which this living has produced, I find that I must come to quite another conclusion. No people has a greater reason for despairing of man, of the human, than our own people. Our pilgrimage began with 400 years of slavery, brutal and brutalizing. Its most recent act was the cremation of 6 million, 1 in 3. And in between, not a generation, but saw the bloodlust, but knew the pogrom, but experienced violent uprooting. Not a generation, but saw nakedly in the eye of their fellow men the beast of prey, Yet Israel never gave up its faith. The weeping may tarry for the night, with the morning there will be joy. And when out of the depths we cry unto the Lord, he answered us with great enlargement. And more than this, and more surprising than this, we not only continued our faith in God, but we sustained our faith in our fellow men. That man is created in the image of God. That man is but little lower than the angels, crowned, if you will, with glory and honor. That man, as the rabbis put it, is a partner with God in the work of creation. A partner with God in the work of creation, not a partner in the work of destruction. Partner with God in the ongoing upbuilding of civilization. And if there is any explanation possible, available to man for Israel's vitality, its eternality, it lies, I believe, in this, that our people doggedly maintained this faith. They refused to have their fundamental roots to man and to God broken and shattered by shattering experience. Where there is no hope, there is no life. Without hope, personality disintegrates, and insanity, the living death, intervenes. As a rabbi, it is my feeling that this current mood of despair, of which we are all in measure, in some measure, partner, is hypocritical, unhealthy, and based on a false assessment of human potential. Hypocrisy means the living of a kind of life which we belie by our speech, the speaking of words which we deny by our actions. Dr. Freud, in this respect, was a hypocrite. One cannot dedicate his life to bringing sanity in the world if one believes that the world is insane. If man is a savage beast, allow him to draw the blinds in front of his eyes, to deny reality. Why should he live in such cruelty? Thank God that Dr. Freud was a hypocrite, but he was one nonetheless. And Dr. Niebuhr is a hypocrite. Dr. Niebuhr has been one of the staunchest social crusaders of our times. He has stood up in pulpit after pulpit and preached a progressive gospel. He is insistent that tyranny must be limited, that freedom must be expanded. But one cannot resurrect such a concept as original sin and insist that man is unequal to the challenge of the day, and at the same time precipitate man into that challenge. Thank God that he is a hypocrite, but he is one nonetheless. And Dr. Russell is a hypocrite. One cannot be, as he has become today, the advocate of establishing rapport among nations, the leader of those who would ban the bomb and ban the testing, one who is willing to take prison and derision for the sake of his political views, and at the same time insist that man is a fly, at the same time play Mephistopheles, mocking at this poor, ignorant, incapable human beast. Thank God that he is a hypocrite, but he is one nonetheless. Had these men held up a truer mirror to themselves, they would not have insisted that man is such a debased, such a deprived, such a perverted, such a limited thing. They are not. They give the living lie to their own protestations. Why do they protest? Out of shock. These were the leaders of the hopeful era of the last century, when men was raising the cities and building the civilization, and when he confidently expected that all would be well within his lifetime with the world. They have read the headlines of the wars They have seen the beast unmasked. They have been traumatized, shocked by this fact. They have forgotten to look for not only the evil, but equally for the potential for the good, for the saintly in life. This present mood is hypocritical, because each of us, when we are cynical about the actions of another, instinctively withdraws himself from this assessment. We know that deep within, we are concerned with honesty. We have a code of honor. We are determined to do something within our limited ambit for the sake of our fellow men. We give the lie to the fatalism and the despair of the day. This mood, I have said, is hypocritical. I believe it also to be unhealthy. Without hope, as I have said, there is no life. Man can live for several weeks without food. He can live for several days without liquid, but not even for minutes, without some hope for himself and for his family. A story is told of a small German village high in the Bavarian hills. It was a backwoods village, superstitious, filled with old wives' tales, and it had three liberated spirits, three men whose education had lifted them beyond the superstitions of their time. Now, one of the superstitions of this village was that if you sat in the village square at high noon, and a black bird would pass over your head, your doom was sealed. And of course, at noonday, the villagers themselves went as far away from the square as they possibly could. And laughing and joking among themselves, these three liberated spirits deliberately sat themselves down on the center bench of the park and made loud jokes about the ignorance of their fellow townspeople. Lo and behold, one day, as the three were laughing and joking, feeling themselves superior, three black birds appeared on the horizon and began flying towards the square. Conversation ceased, and then picked up again, and then ceased, but all eyes were on the birds. And you know the end of the story. As the birds began to pass over the park, the men bolted from the bench. The Bible explains it. Im lo ta'aminu az lo ta'amenu. Where there is no hope, there is no staying power, there is no courage, there is no will to live. There is no suppleness against the buffets of life. There is no backbone to carry men erect through life. But that hope is psychologically functional. It does not in and of itself, of course, invalidate this despairing view of man. Are you saying to us, Rabbi, that there is no evil in man? That there is no wickedness to be seen in our world? Are you playing Pollyanna? Not at all. There is evil in the world and in man. There are evil men. There is wickedness in the world and in men. There are deliberately wicked men. There is a very good chance that our world will not survive. But what I am insisting on is that there is no metaphysical law which insists that we are doomed. What I am insisting upon is that man is not only sinner, but saint. That they are not only greedy men, but great-hearted men. That they are not only callous men, but courageous men. That they are not only short-sighted men, but men of vision and leadership and of determination. In brief, that man is, in some cases, animal, and in some cases, human. That there are some humans who grow and some who grow up. And that those who do grow up spiritually and emotionally as well as physically have in each age been ultimately equal to the challenge of their time. For I ask myself, why is it that those who predict that there will be no future torture themselves to write about it? And why do we torture ourselves to read about it? Why is it that if we despair of life and of man, we begrudge leaving this world? Wouldn't it be far simpler to be our own gravedigger here and now, while the sun is shining and the air is fresh and full of spring? Why do we begrudge leaving this justice, this freedom, this city, this faith, this home, those whom we love? Is not our instinctive attachment, our appraisal of the worth of these people and these things and these laws and these conditions itself the proof of man's potential, of man's capacity, of civilization's worthwhileness? If man were altogether depraved, he would still be loincloth, jungle beasts. If man were altogether violent, how do you explain our law and our freedom? How do you explain that in 4,000 or 5,000 years of literate history, man has raised himself from jungle to urban civilization? No, all is not perfect. No, the world is not free of fear, but full of danger. And the danger lies, as it has always lain, in us. But what I insist upon is that we have the capacity, the power, the mind, the spirit, the heart, the ability, if we will it, to build this kind of building, a civilization dedicated to that which is good and worthwhile, which soars and rises and overarches, which protects and encourages and enlightens. One sympathizes with this mood of despair, but it is self-defeating. It is worthless as a philosophy. It is stupid as an ethic, for it can lead us only to the old Epicurean position, eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we die. Now I think instinctively we respond when a rabbi speaks this ancient truth, that man is potentially godlike, that he has in him capacity equal to the challenges of life, that God did not put us upon this earth to mock at us sadistically, watching our pathetic antics as we try to survive and push off as far as we can the inevitable doom. We are proud to think of ourselves in these terms. But if we are wise, we set pride aside and we take on the dress of humility. For if we are the masters of the future, the builders of tomorrow, if it rests in our hands and on our shoulders, then how do we explain the quality of our lives? How do we explain the hours of indolence, the weeks in which we shut ourselves away, we isolate ourselves from our community? Our desire to set ourselves apart from the pressures, the turmoil of life. If life is our responsibility, then we must put an end to armchair citizenship. Then we must recognize that we are the pivotal generation in the saga of man. We have unlimited power for good, for ill. If our generation stabilizes civilization, the future generations, building on the international and national orders of law and justice, will work out the details of this utopia. If our generation cracks under the strain, fails, withdraws itself, there is no future. Life is erased. The germ cells begin again. Some new species evolves. Of no generation before, and probably of no generation since, will the same urgency be required. And what is more pathetic than the psychology of suburbia in such an urgent generation? The disjunct. I separate myself. I will earn my living, but I feel no responsibility to earn my right to live. I will work, but for my own. We cannot live atom lives, disjuncted lives. Radiation, cindering of the bomb, will not separate us out and say, you of the wealthier, the more literate, the more able will survive. You of the center city, the less literate, the less able, will be cindered. We will all go down in a common grave. Equally, we all have a common mission, a common ambition, a common hope, and a more than common, an extraordinary responsibility. An urgency, a command, God's order. Here is life. Here are the things I gave you. Consider how fortunate you are to be born when you are, to be trained and to be educated, to be healed, to grow strong and straight the land that is free. How can you justify taking so much, and in some cases, returning little, if anything at all? There is an old midrash, and with this I close. That creation, God took Adam to a high cliff overlooking the world. And he pointed out to us, to Adam, the world's geography. He taught Adam how to raise crops from the earth. He spoke to Adam of the mineral wealth tunneled deep into the rock of the ground. He spoke to him even of the power which is in the air, of the dreams which we in our day are realizing. He said to Adam this, simply and bluntly, I made this world. It is now your world. To make of it what you will and what you can. All that you need is there. If you but use it wisely and use it well. Adam's challenge is ours. He was not equal completely for the task. We must be. There is little room, there is little time for error.